Welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tans in Washington, working on this program very much. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Wednesday, September 7, 2022. South Sudanese authorities say thousands of people have been displaced by floods in some parts of the country.
I think northern Baragazal is partially affected. And of course, the chronic situation in the areas of Unity and Upper Nile.
And the head of the UN mission in South Sudan praises Khartoum for ensuring stability in South Sudan.
We took note together of recent developments in South Sudan, including the unification of the armed forces and the adoption of a roadmap which provided new timelines for critical developments in the South Sudan transition.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The chairperson of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission says more than 100,000 people have been displaced by floods in four states. An official with the UN in South Sudan says aid workers have dispatched teams to the affected areas for assessment. For VOA News, Dengai Deng reports from Bor.
Manasseh Lomele, chairperson of the South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission, says the affected people in parts of Unity, Jonglei, Lakes and northern Bahr al-Ghazal states are in dire need of assistance after floodwaters washed away their livelihoods.
I have been in touch with our partner and also with our staff on the ground. They have given me information about the flood situation. Mm-hmm. Well, parts of, I think, northern Bahr al-Ghazal is partially affected. And, of course, the chronic situation in the areas of Unity and Upper Nile.
Galoak Nyang, Commissioner of Unity State Mayendit County, says at least 15 people have drowned in floodwaters. 12 others were bitten by snakes and 8,800 households have been displaced in the last 2 months. Nyang says more than 59,000 residents in three villages were forced to move to higher grounds in southern Mayendit County.
The situation now is out of control. Yeah, in Mayendit South, we lost 3 highlands. We remain with 2 highlands. In Gabwal, the same thing. All the village and all the boomers are under control of water. The same to Mirnyal. And even the pressure now, what is remaining is just that the heritage. So Camp Rupai now is, even the market in the center now is taken. Just people are staying in a very, very small place.
Commissioner Nyang says there is a shortage of medicine and the situation is made worse by poor hygiene, resulting in the outbreaks of waterborne diseases. Nyang is calling on humanitarian agencies to intervene in Mayendit.
So the first need now is the health. Now the waterborne disease will break out in the area. That one is now a concern. So we need mosquito net. It's very important. Plus, now people are crowding in very small places, and the challenge is now with the latrine. There's no latrine. So this one will, if we did not manage to get some latrine, so the waterborne disease will develop, and this one will be very serious to the people. Plus the food now, there is a shortage of food. Since April, no one received food in the area.
Wilfred Vundro, the reporting officer at the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in South Sudan, says OCHA has dispatched teams to the affected areas for assessment before it intervenes.
We, however, got two reports from the authorities that floods started impacting people in a number of locations across the country. But this information only came from the government counterparts, the RRC, humanitarian organizations are mobilizing in those affected locations to verify this information and also to get the actual number of people who have been impacted. And based on that, they will mobilize for response to those locations. But and to see if they can respond.
Vundru urges people in flood-affected areas to remain patient as humanitarian agencies carry out their assessments. Recent media reports in South Sudan say a 40-year-old woman drowned in floodwaters in Awerial County of Lake State last Friday. Authorities in Maban County of Upper Nile State say at least 7 people have drowned in floodwaters there. In March, the UN Refugee Agency warned that prolonged flooding and displacement in South Sudan was expected to worsen once the rainy season begins. Some critics, including civil society activists, say the government did not plan properly to help citizens in flood-prone areas. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng in Bor.
The head of the United Nations mission in South Sudan is thanking IGAD countries for their role in South Sudan's peace implementation process. The special representative of the UN Secretary General in South Sudan stressed the spirit of responsibility shown by neighboring Sudan towards the successful transition in South Sudan. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
UNMISS Chief Nicholas Haysom, who arrived Khartoum on Sunday, met with the head of Sudan Sovereignty Council, Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, current chair of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, to provide an update on developments in South Sudan's peace implementation process. Shortly after meeting with al-Burhan on Tuesday, Haysom praised Sudan's supportive stance for the success of lasting peace and stability in South Sudan. Haysom called the recent graduation of unified forces a positive step towards the full implementation of the peace agreement.
We took note together of recent developments in South Sudan, including the unification of the armed forces and the adoption of a roadmap which provided new timelines for critical developments in the South Sudan transition.
The new timeline extends the unity government's transition period by another 2 years. Last week, some 20,000 unified forces were graduated in Juba in accordance with Chapter 2 of the Revitalized Peace Agreement on Security Arrangements. The unified forces spent more than 2 years in training centers across the country. During that time, many soldiers left the centers due to lack of food and other resources. Haysom praised IGAD countries for their role in overseeing the full implementation of the Revitalized Peace Deal in South Sudan.
I wanted to stress the role and, in fact, the responsibility of the neighbors of South Sudan towards ensuring the success of the transition. And in particular, I stress the important role that IGAD has as both a guarantor and in a sense, the owner of the agreement in ensuring that there is a successful implementation of the benchmarks that are set out in the peace agreement.
At the same briefing, the head of South Sudan Affairs at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Ambassador Geriballa Khedir, said al-Burhan reiterated Sudan's keenness on completing the peace process and achieving democratic transformation in South Sudan. He says Sudan will continue working to bring South Sudan's parties closer together and support the transitional period in the country. Khedir describes the recent graduation of the first batch of unified forces as a serious step towards peace.
Our president gave a full explanation about the role being played by Sudan as a neighboring country which has a special relation with South Sudan and as the current head of the IGAD organization. The meeting explored all the developments that are related to the full implementation of the revitalized peace agreement among the parties in South Sudan.
The IGAD organization, which is currently chaired by Sudan, is comprised of 7 countries, namely Sudan, Ethiopia, Djibouti, Kenya, Uganda, Somalia, and South Sudan. The regional organization supports member states in their development efforts, especially in the areas of peace processes and food security. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
Still on UN issues, the UN's Children Fund has said hundreds of children in Somalia have already died in food and nutritional centers the day after warnings that parts of the country will be hit by famine this year.
That grim revelation comes the day after the UN's humanitarian chief warned that parts of the country will be hit by famine in the coming months. Experts say the Horn of Africa is heading towards a fifth consecutive failed rainy season, further exacerbating the region's worst drought in decades. UNICEF's Somalia representative, Wafar Saeed, told a press conference in Geneva that 730 children have been reported to have died in food and nutrition centres between January and July this year.
And to put it into perspective, this is less than 1% of the children who were admitted and cured and discharged. But we also fear that this number could be more as many deaths of children go unreported.
UNICEF said disease outbreaks were increasing among children. There have been some 13,000 suspected measles cases reported in recent months, of which 78% were children under five.
Malnutrition has reached unprecedented level. We have 1.5 million children. This is nearly half of the children under five are likely to have acute malnutrition. And of them, 385,000 will need treatment for severe acute malnutrition.
On Monday, UN Humanitarian Chief Martin Griffiths said famine is at the door in Somalia. He said there were concrete indications that parts of South Central Somalia would be hit between October and December this year. Funding for Somalia has increased in recent weeks, with the UN's $1.46 billion appeal now 67% funded. But aid officials warned that it had come very late and that more was needed.
Somali's president, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, has fired and replaced the mayor of the capital, Mogadishu, Omar Falish. Analysts say the president was dissatisfied with security in the capital, where Islamist militants killed 21 people at a hotel last month. Mohamed Desani reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
In a decree issued Wednesday, President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud appointed Yusuf Hussein Jimale as Mogadishu's new mayor. In the decree, Mahmoud said that he took the action on the recommendation of the Interior Ministry. He said the new mayor, who also becomes the governor of the Banadir Regional Administration, has the experience to fulfill his new responsibilities. Yusuf Hussein Jimale, better known as Madale, will replace Omar Mahmoud Mohamed Filish, who had been mayor since August 2019. Filish was criticized for lack of development projects during his term. The city has also seen continued attacks from militant group Al-Shabaab, most recently in August, when fighters stormed a popular hotel, killing 21 people and wounding more than 100 others. The Somali president did not say why he was firing Filish, but political analysts say the new president wanted to install a mayor who can follow his development and security policies. Jimale was also mayor of Mogadishu from 2015 and 2017, when Mahmoud served his first term as president. Mohamed Daisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the Biden administration makes a decision against designating Russia as a state sponsor of terror. Stay tuned for that story after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how is the birth of a child celebrated in your culture?
When we give birth in our culture, they simply take a baby somewhere there inside a house. They gather together as a family. They bring pots of milk. They slaughter goats. So they dance. That's how we easily celebrate.
I understand in a very simple way that when a baby boy is born, it is celebrated for the first 3 days with some local drinks, some local beverages, something of that kind.
They give them cows. Yeah, once you give birth to a baby, they give him or her cattle. So that's the way how they celebrate it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre said on Tuesday that U.S. President Joe Biden has made a final decision against designating Russia as a state sponsor of terror. Biden on Monday said Russia should not be designated a state sponsor of terrorism, a label Ukraine has pushed for amid Russia's ongoing invasion, while Moscow has warned it will rupture U.S.-Russia relations. Jean-Pierre said the designation of Russia as state sponsor of terror could delay food exports and jeopardize deals to move goods through the Black Sea.
It is not the most effective or strongest path forward, as we have said many times before, to hold Russia accountable. This designation could have unintended consequences to Ukraine and the world. For example, according to humanitarian experts and NGOs we have spoken to, it could seriously affect the ability to deliver assistance in areas of Ukraine. Another one is it could drive critical humanitarian and commercial actors away from facilitating food exports to help mitigate the global food crisis and jeopardize the Black Sea port deal that has already led to over 1 million tons of Ukrainian food exports reaching the world, including those on the Horn of Africa likely facing famine. It would also undercut our unprecedented multilateral condition that has been so effective to holding Putin accountable and could also undermine our ability to support Ukraine at the negotiation tables.
Following the recent visit to Tunisia by Barbara Leaf, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, the State Department says that the U.S. is committed to supporting Tunisia in laying the foundation for political stability and economic growth. However, Tunisian political parties say the government of President Kais Saied is unable and unqualified to face Tunisia's challenges. VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi discussed these developments with Sarah Yaks, a senior fellow at the Koinagi Endowment for International Peace.
I think what we've seen is that Saied was really not happy about the statement that came out following Barbara Leaf's visit. And if you look at the readout from the Tunisian side, it's very different from that of the U.S. side. Saied said he rejected U.S. interference in Tunisia's affairs. He affirmed Tunisian sovereignty, and he pushed back against a variety of U.S. statements that have been critical of his actions. So what we can see is that clearly Saied is paying attention to what U.S. officials have to say. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he is being swayed by U.S. pressure. I think these engagements are really important for Saied to realize that the international community is paying attention to what he does. But we shouldn't expect them to have a major impact on his behavior or change the path that he's taking the country on right now.
Meanwhile, the Tunisian opposition accused President Kais Saied of pledging the country's sovereignty to the IMF and attempting to involve Tunisia in regional conflicts in reference to his recent reception of the leader of the Polisario Front, Ibrahim Ghali, which caused a diplomatic crisis with Morocco. What's your take on that?
So I think on the IMF deal, this is really nothing new. You know, for the entirety of Tunisia's transition, we have seen major societal cleavages over the proposed IMF reforms, with some parties on the left and the unions rejecting the reforms and other parties accepting them and encouraging them. So Saied is in a really difficult position because he needs the IMF deal, both for the support it would provide, but also to help unlock additional international financing. But he also needs the support of the union and the public as pushback against him and his actions has been growing, and he really is hemorrhaging support. So the crisis with Morocco is not coming at a very good time for him. You know, he's been cozying up to Algeria, and Algeria has been one of the most vocal supporters of Saied's actions and one of the only countries to actually give some support to Tunisia during this last year. So it's not really surprising that Tunisia could end up in hot water with Morocco over its growing closeness to Algeria. But this particular crisis and allowing Ghali to have a seat at this conference and to play the role of sort of a leader of an independent state has upset not only Morocco, but also many Tunisians, and is just an unnecessary complication for Saied at what is already a very difficult time for him.
Political parties in Tunisia warned on Monday that the country is facing imminent collapse and chaos, and in a joint statement, they said that the government of President Kais Saied is unable and unqualified to face challenges, and according to the parties, Saied alone is responsible for the consequences of imminent collapse and chaos in light of his inability to lead a salvation mission. What could that lead to in Tunisia?
I think this is one more signal that Saied no longer represents the will of the people, as he claims. Now, he has had sole control over the country for a year, and he's failed to implement any sort of policies or reforms to assist Tunisia in addressing its economic and social crises. So what we could see coming out of this is further clashes, whether that's protests, sit-ins, other forms of nonviolent resistance against Saied by the public, who is growing increasingly wary of what he is doing and increasingly impatient at his inability to deliver. But the real question, I think, is how does he respond to these public displays of satisfaction? Does he allow peaceful protests, or does he push back violently, as he has done sometimes in the past, leading to further chaos? And I think Tunisia is really at this critical point right now. We're not sure which direction the country is going to go.
That's Sarah X, a senior fellow at the Koinange Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed Al-Ashanawi. The African Union is 20 years old this year since its founding in July 2002. Some have praised the organization for strengthening Africa's voice on the global stage, but critics say the African Union has done a poor job in dealing with multitude of conflicts and unconstitutional changes of government on the continent. Adoye Akinola is the head of research and teaching at the University of Johannesburg's Institute of Pan-African Thought and Conversation. The institute will host a three-day symposium in early November to reflect on the African Union at 20 years and how the continental body can ensure sustainable peace. Akinola tells VOA's James Batty that the African Union's financial and institutional weakness have impacted its effectiveness, and its peace and security mechanism has underperformed.
First and foremost, I think there have been relatively lack of commitment among the political elites that are driving the African regional agenda, which is slightly different from the regionalism that we have in Europe, for example, where you have the technocrats, the civil society organization, and private sector driving the integration process in a way. One of the constraints has been lack of this political will. Then, too, because the state itself in Africa has been part of the problem, and the political elites in this case have been the people championing the cause and the direction of the African Union. So it has been very difficult for the AU to actually intervene the way that a regional or supranational organization would have loved to do. There's also this struggle between the what we call the R2P, the responsibility to intervene when human lives are in jeopardy. But there's still this understanding in Africa that the sovereignty of the members must be respected, and many of the leaders of this state, even causing the conflict, are part of the actors within the AU that will sit and meet. And so there's all kinds of complications. We also need to be mindful of the rapidity of conflict, the resurgence of maybe military coup, for instance. It is actually happening at a faster pace than the structures within the AU. The African standby force also have been particularly weak.
Let's take Ethiopia-Tigray conflict as one example of the conflicts happening around Africa. What would you say about the AU's role?
The AU have been particularly passive. Maybe they are passive because of the individual, the actor involved, because of his personality within the AU. Or maybe they are passive because they are very close to the crisis zone. Or the expectation is just that since we have a standby force, this is not about supporting a faction. It's just to make sure that there are humanitarian assistance. But the AU secretariat itself is just about less than 1,200 kilometers to the conflict zone. If the AU standby force or whatever peace architecture, even like the early warning system or the Council of the Wise, could not stop the conflict in Ethiopia. How can they stop conflict in South Sudan? How can they stop conflict in Somalia? So that's really what we call a blemish on the part of the AU.
There are those who give the African Union high marks. For example, they say, well, the African Union is there and is bringing about a more united Africa, also democracy.
Yeah, one thing we can really commend the AU for is to roll out a very stimulating program, targets, agenda like the 2063. But despite the optimism that surrounds it, but there is also this pessimism that the AU might not be able to even drive their member states to achieve this agenda. For instance, if you talk of their ability to promote democracy, then the question is, what kind of democracy is being promoted in Africa? It's actually elitist democracy, elitist form of democracy. It's not really a representative form of democracy. How can there be democracy where people even within Africa are hostile to one another? How can there be governance when the locals in the state are revolting against foreigners that came from the same African state?
That was Adeoye Akinola, head of research and teaching at the University of Johannesburg's Institute for Pan-African Thought and Conversation. He spoke with my colleague, James Batty.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
That's all we prepared for you this Tuesday. Don't forget to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. And for world news, go to voanews.com. If you missed this broadcast, go to voanews.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with Mawa and the song Binia.
Reaching out to the brokenhearted, I'm reaching out to the lost souls, I'm reaching out to the absent-minded, I'm reaching out to the sick and alone. I'm reaching out to the brokenhearted, I'm reaching out to the lost souls, I'm reaching out to the absent-minded, I'm reaching out to the sick and alone. Ana bimiru idatai, bijuru ita, kanita waga. Ana biguna guna tai, bijibu fara, kangel fawaja. Ana maderi tageni barao, ae, ana bija. Ana maderi tageni feki, walele, ana bija. Ana maderi tageni kore, ya mami, ana bija. Ana maderi tajere sambala, ae, ana bija. Binia, itaya umatai. Binia, itaya ukutai. Binia, itaya jenatai. Binia, itaya maratai.
Through the stumbles and through the falls, I will always be there for you. By your side, day and night, and I ain't never gonna let you go. When the night's getting dark and cold, Kelita Arugali anabija. When you're all by yourself at home, Kelita Arugali anabija. Ana maderita geni bara.
We have been listening to Mawa and the song Binia. I'm your host, John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for taking time to be with us this evening. Remember to join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Anamaderita jere sambala, ae, anabija, binia.
Atari Binia Itaya Okotai Binia Itaya Genatai Binia Itaya Maratai.